I'm Al Roboteau, and I teach religion at Princeton University, specializing in American religious history, encounters among African Americans, Native Americans, and Europeans, and written a book called Slave Religion, and a couple of other books, and I'm now dabbling in literature, which is what I began. I majored in literature, English literature, as an undergraduate at Loyola in Los Angeles, now Loyola Marymount. And then I got a master's degree in English literature at Berkeley many years ago. So I'm old enough that they allow me to do what I want at Princeton. So for the past couple of years, I've been teaching courses in literature. One called Reenchanting the World, Religion and Literature of Fantasy, which is a quite popular course, though it's restricted because it's a seminar to 15 students. And then a new one called Holy Ordinary, the Location of the Sacred in Contemporary Literature, which is also restricted because it's a seminar. And that's about all I want to say about myself right now. And you have read,
and we're thrilled to have you. We've read Hidden Wholeness,
okay,
from Fire and Bones, okay, a fabulous piece on Merton and King. We've read American Salvation. Many have read your works in other courses. And we just invite you to share from those two essays, and we'll see what happens.
Okay.
And look forward to the lecture at 6 o'clock.
Right.
And we'll go to maybe 5, a quarter till 5. So we have, you know, just over an hour.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, I certainly cannot attend the lecture here. This is a seminar. Mm-hmm. And since some of you will be hearing me tonight on the lecture. So perhaps it would be useful for me to talk about how I came to write both of those essays, and then to open up for questions that you may have, comments. I'm trying to, as I get older, to efface my ego, so don't feel reluctant to criticize what I've written. That's fine. I'll still talk to you, and love to get exchanges from you about your impressions and reactions to those two essays, and also to the brief memoir, Sorrowful Joy. How you think it may relate to some of the deeper themes of this course, which is a comparison of Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King Jr. Sorrowful Joy was written, as those of you read it know, as the Harold Witt lectures. Harold Witt was a Harvard undergrad. He is a Harvard undergrad. He's still very much alive. He left money to the Harvard Divinity School for a lectureship that would deal with the question of religious life in contemporary society and the possibilities of it. And he wanted the lecture to be personal or autobiographical rather than academic. And so in a moment of foolhardiness, I agreed to do it and began to work on it. And one day I was sitting in my office and I had a phone call from Mr. DeWitt and Mr. Witt saying, you know, I've been a little unsatisfied with some of the previous lectures. They haven't been autobiographical enough. Are you sure you're going to be autobiographical? I said, don't worry about it, Mr. Witt. So I took him at his word and used it as opportunity to look back on my life. And as with all autobiography, any of you who've written journals or keep diaries know that there is something fictive about it, that you're trying to create a structure and meaning and a kind of integral narrative that is not, you know, necessarily totally factual, that this is a constructed reality, but it reveals to the reader, as best you can, your take, in this case my take, upon the meaning of my life for me at the time in which I was writing. Somebody else observing my life might, you know, have written a very different narrative.
Your daughter, for example.
Yes, my daughter Emily, who wrote an autobiographical novel called The Professor's Daughter, which when I first heard the title, scared me to death. And then she wrote me a very nice note and sent me page proofs of the novel, saying, "Dad, I hope you aren't offended by anything in this novel." She said, "A large part of why I wrote it was to figure out who you are, because you are, to some extent, a mystery to me. And I love you very much." Mm-hmm. So I was very, very touched by that. But I've still had to tell many friends, did that really happen? No, it's only fiction. So she has a different take on our life together than I do. But it's a good novel, if you have time to read novels. So this was my attempt to be consciously autobiographical, which is something that doesn't occur often in the academy. We're trained to try to efface ourselves as much as possible and to be objective. But of course, we always do enter in, willingly or not, into the work that we do. If you've read the text, I think it's clear to you who the influences on my life are that I attest, and what events in my life have had the greatest impact on me. One of them being the death of my father, the murder of my father 3 months before I was born in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. I was just saying a few minutes ago to Howard that I had just come back from Mississippi this summer, where I took Emily, my daughter, and my youngest son, Martin, who has never been south. Emily has been. She worked one summer in New Orleans and has been back a few times. But Martin had not been there, and part of my intent was to take him to see his grandfather's grave. It was interesting to return to Bay St. Louis after Katrina. I hadn't been there since the storm. And to meet with about 26 of my first cousins, some of whom I didn't know, who entertained us with a wonderful brunch. And to reconnect with the history, the autobiography that some of you have read, and to realize that I am now the generation of the people that I'm writing about in that book, and that for my children to come along is for them to have a different sense, but a sense of that linked connection with a history of a people, that they don't just exist in a small family or just exist as isolated individuals, but that they are extended backwards in time by their connections to these people, and that's real, made real by visiting the place where I came from, where their grandparents came from, and being able to see and touch their grandfather's grave. I never knew my father, clearly. He was killed 3 months before I was born, but his death, as I say in the text, left a long shadow on my life, in part because my parents, my mother, and my stepfather, she remarried when I was 4, didn't really talk to me about the details of his death. And so I was always clouded by it, wondering whether there was something shameful about his death. And eventually, when I was 15, about just graduated from high school, 16, they sat me down and told me the full circumstances. And again, as you know, it took me until I was 50 to really come to terms with that death in a deep emotional way by visiting his grave and by actually, in my mind's eye, however these things work, seeing him shot, seeing him falling from a ladder, seeing him falling into my life. And it was a very deep and important experience for me. Reconnecting me to that mystery in a way that somehow was healing in a very deep place within me. So that's about all I'll say right now about A Sorrowful Joy. Let me just talk about the other two pieces and then open up for discussion. American Salvation was written as the 25th anniversary Alexander Schneemann lecture at St. Vladimir's Orthodox Seminary in Crestwood, New York. Alexander Schneemann was an Orthodox theologian who specialized in the study and the meaning of the sacraments. Systematic theologian would be termed in Western jargon. And I had first read Schneemann when I was a graduate student in theology at Marquette in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And actually remember, I actually introduced the lecture by this anecdote. Remember going to a lecture by the Jesuit philosopher, theologian Bernard Lonergan. And we were waiting for Lonergan to speak. And my two roommates, graduate students in theology, who had a very irreverent sense of humor, decided that we were going to imitate some theologians. So one of my roommates was Carl Rahner. And Marty, my other roommate, was Edward Skilabex. And I was, for some reason, long before I became Orthodox, was Alexander Schneemann. And we actually adopted the accents of the respective German. Skilabex is Dutch, and Schneemann was Russian, immigrated by way of Paris. So we adopted their accents. So I said this, Mrs. Schneemann, his widow happened to be in the front row. She smiled, so it was okay. So this was a lecture in which I was trying to wrestle with the question of this antinomy of being in the world but not of the world, which Schneemann had a lot to say about. And the punchline of the piece comes from Schneemann, which is the purpose of the church being in the world but not of the world, that is, being not of the world is not out of rejection of the world, but is to be in a stance, a place where it can be the source of the transformation of the world, of love and acceptance of the world. And that tension of being in the world but not of the world is one that has lived and been vexed and troubled in the history of Christianity from at least the epistle to Diognetus very early on. And that there have been certain choices that have been made in terms of the antinomy of being in the world, that is incarnational, and being not of the world, that is being a transcendent reality, that have sometimes tried to relax the antinomy by choosing one side or the other. And that doing that creates problems. So that's what that essay originated as. And I tried to make that case, not in the abstract, but in the concrete of American politics at the time it was written. Which, to be frank, was a fairly gutsy move to make. And what happened was that the essay, unlike all of the other Schneemann lectures, was never published. So my editor, Deb Chasman, wonderful editor from Beacon Press, who had edited my book, Fire and Bones, one day called me up and said, "You have anything hanging around that we could publish in Boston Review?" She left Beacon to go to Boston Review. And I said, "Well, I got this piece," so I sent it to her. And she said, "Let me work with it a little bit and edit it," you know, and it was published in the Boston Review. And then became a very popular piece, not just generally, but I heard from all kinds of Orthodox parishes that they had pulled it off the web and were reprinting it and discussing it in the parishes. So however controversial the piece might have been in its original arena, it was able to subversively get spread in the audience room that was intended initially. As I reread the essay, I think, boy, I should have tried to... There are about three essays in there that I tried to combine, so if you want to work on unpacking some of that, I'd be happy to. The third piece that you read, Hidden Wholeness, Thomas Merton and Martin Luther King Jr., originated as a talk that was given, I think, it was 1968, I think it was the 20th anniversary of their deaths. They both died in 1968. so I think it was in 1988. I actually finished writing that lecture at an American Studies Association conference in Miami Beach, and I asked them if I could. I had to give it in 2 days, and you know, I had it roughed out, and they put me in the bowels of the hotel. There was no windows, and I'm at a computer for 2 days hammering this out. I think I saw the beach maybe twice during went to no sessions in the conference, but I finished it. I gave it in Atlanta, and there was actually a Trappist monk there from Conyers, Holy Trinity Monastery, and he liked it. It was my attempt to bring together two people who had been the most formative spiritual influences on my life, Merton and King. And to say, what might they have said to each other? What convergences might they have been? Had they met as intended? In the final year of his life, Merton was moving more and more towards wanting to adopt a more ascetic lifestyle, a more Gandhian lifestyle, in which he wanted to sell his house, he wanted to fast, he wanted to try to arrange for periods of silence and contemplative solitude. And some of his lieutenants being informed about this, talked to, I don't know quite how they discovered it, but a couple called the Youngbloods, who were friends of Merton's, got in touch with Merton about this. And they began to make arrangements for him to have an extended stay at Gethsemane to engage in dialogue with Merton. And it didn't happen because of his assassination. So this was a thought experiment. What might these two people have had to say to each other had they had the opportunity for a dialogue? You know, clearly informed by my own consciousness of what they had to say to me in my life since the time I was 13 when I first began reading Merton. So that's how those texts came about. Sometimes I think it may be elucidating to, at the risk of the authorial fallacy, to know that. I often ask my students, why do you think this author wrote this? Why did he or she write this at this particular time? What's the context for it? So those were the context for these particular pieces which you've read. So with that, let me open up for discussion, questions, objections, attacks, whatever you might want to pursue. And don't be bashful.
I was just open up this sort of question. So in any of the works, could you describe, now that you look back at them, tell me what you remember and read. And geez, I would have changed this, geez, I would have X'd that out, I would have not said that. If you had to edit yourself, or you had to, what do you, so it feels like, oof, that wasn't such a good one.
Well, the first regret I had was, I knew, because it was in the contract I signed to deliver the lectures, that they were going to be published. But I had forgotten about that until I got a letter from Polish Press saying, you're going to publish, it's time for us to publish your lecture. I thought, I'm pretty autobiographical in that, what are my colleagues going to say? And to a person, at least those who read it and remarked upon it, they were very kind in what they said. As I look back on it, I think one thing I would say is I wish it were better written. I think I would write it probably a little better than I did. The craft of writing is important to me. But I don't think there's anything fundamental that would change it. It is my take on what happened. I probably would open up a little bit more to some of the things that happened that I witnessed in the 60s and afterwards. I was asked by a historian in our history department at Princeton four different times to give a lecture to their introductory history class on life during the 60s, life during the civil rights movement from somebody who was there at the time. So I highlighted different aspects of the talks than I did in the text. I might have highlighted those more, or to do it again, less than open it out more by talking about some of the politics, things I was involved in the 60s. Also, if I were to write it again, of course, I would bring it up to date, in which a lot of things have happened since the ending of the text. I don't think there's anything major that I would change. Is there something you'd like me to change?
No. Okay. We were talking in my office about the impact of the King papers on King scholarship.
Yes.
How have these papers changed your?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think that's in terms of, not in terms of my biography, but in terms of autobiography, in terms of the essay on King and Merton. Certainly, I think the publication of the papers has revealed would complicate my picture of King in some ways. In some ways, I think my picture has been validated by the papers. In some ways, I think I would have complicated my picture of him. But as with my own biography, King's own rendering of his intellectual biography is much more simple than it was. How I might deal with that in the paper, in that essay, I'm not sure. I would certainly take that into account. I probably would lay more stress on some of the figures who were influential upon King, who I really don't mention in the text, though I think I do mention Mordecai Johnson. Famous Gandhi speech. I think I mentioned a little bit more about how much King learns from other people like Guy Rustin, major influence on Montgomery, as you know from your readings, conceptualization of Montgomery and the notion of Montgomery as leading to a movement. The connections through Rustin with Glenn Smiley and the whole tradition of nonviolence coming out of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And other figures that have been uncovered in the black intellectual tradition who were Gandhian pacifists, kind of Gandhian non-resisters. I've written on Thurman elsewhere, so I probably would integrate Thurman a little bit more into the background there. Speaking of the papers, this volume is a very interesting one in terms of the whole debate about, the influence on King and the influence of the intellectual life of King's stream at Crozier, Morehouse, Crozier, Boston, as it relates to the black church tradition, his family tradition, mentors in Atlanta and elsewhere. This is a very interesting volume. It's volume 6 of the papers, which has the title Advocate of the Social Gospel, unlike any of the other volumes, deals with cross chronology. It goes back to September 1948 and up to March 1963. Now, the King papers, I think in volume 5, do you have volume 5?
This is 3, this is the Montgomery.
Okay, I think volume 5 comes down to about 63, or maybe even again. Okay, I think it comes down to about 63, if I'm not mistaken. What happened was an editor's nightmare. Clay Carson found out that there were a whole set of unexamined sermons of King's, sermons and sermon notes, in the basement of the old SCLC house office in Atlanta. The first thing he realized, at least I think I would have realized, is that there's going to be materials there that should have been in volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4. But wisely, they didn't do an addendum. What they did do was to assemble all of those sermons and papers and publish them here as sermons that deal with King. One of the major themes of these sermons is King and the social gospel. And what that tends to do is to mitigate some of the criticisms that have been made of King with regard to, let me put it that way, because I don't want to create a false controversy. What they've done is to both show that King was influenced, of course, by his education, but also that very early on, he had a strong commitment from these sermons and sermon notes to nonviolence, nonviolent direct action as a political tactic. He was talking about love and Gandhian terms quite early on. So the notion, at least the notion that this, you know, is a Johnny come lately in terms of Gandhi, so he doesn't know much about it, that needs to be, I think, taken with a grain of salt given the evidence of these earlier sermons. Anyway, it's a very interesting volume, and you know, I recommend that you look at, especially the long introduction by Clay Carson that prefaces this document. So in those ways, the papers would probably achieve that. Also, Greater Merton's papers, particularly five volumes of letters, had not come out when that essay was published, written and published. And some amazing writing, some of Merton's best writing is not only in his journals, which also I don't believe had come out in seven volumes when that was written, but also in his letters. Actually, the letters may have been out, but the journals weren't out, because there was a 25-year restriction on the publication. So the journals have come out, and some fascinating things in those journals that were affected by complicated my picture of Merton as well. Some dreams that he had that are really interesting. Jim Douglas in his biography, what's it called? The Hidden Wisdom, I think is the title of it. Or is it the Search for Wisdom, I think. Yeah, Search for Wisdom. Talks somewhat about the dreams and what they might have meant in terms of Merton's development. So had I had those resources, I certainly would have been a different essay. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question about the relation of being in the world, but out of the world, but not out of the world in American Salvation, and you mentioned marginality, which you're holding in American USA. It seems like in both ways, in the world and not out of the world, is a way to develop a critical distance from society in order to critique it in other words. In the same way, you suggest that American in deliberately choosing sort of marginalized position as a monk getting to live has a marginal space, whereas King is just imposed. And I'd ask if we should understand your position within American Salvation in the world and of the world as assuming or cultivating a certain marginality, or otherwise are there critical spaces which we can inhabit, especially in terms of perhaps theologians and academy, because so it's this intersection of church and university in a not quite so marginal way. Are there critical spaces that we can inhabit which are not coded as marginal, or is such a critical space, even of the church, always a type of cultivated marginality?
Yeah. That's an excellent question. And one way of answering it, I think, is to say that as members of the academy, I think we do need to sometimes seek ways to distance ourselves from business as usual in the academy. And I would be a little critical of the academy. Business as usual meaning knowledge as a commodity, knowledge as simply as the exchange of information, knowledge of us working in the kind of cultural workshop. Is it more than that? Is it devoted to the search for wisdom? Is it the love of learning as the desire for God? To use the title of a book by Jean Leclerc on medieval Benedictine concepts of learning. I take this on in an essay that you didn't read that's published in Cross Currents. Do you know the journal Cross Currents? It's an essay which was kind of my rationale for developing a course called Reenchanting the World. and it's called Reenchanting the World, Wisdom, Learning, and Education. And it's available on the web. Just type in Roboto and Reenchanting the World and you get it. So it's a full-blown answer to your question. And what I try to argue briefly is that I think we need to understand education and connect it to a form of initiation into the wisdom traditions of the world. That is, we mean people who work and write in the academy. And that there's a need to understand what we do that moves ourselves from kind of proprietary interest in mastery. This is my field, you know, the anxiety of influence. And I'm going to trash who's got before because I need to carve out space for me to publish in this field. No, this is much more. We're part of much more of a community that, again, of scholars that stretches back in time and will go forward in time, of a guild, if you will, and that we try to initiate young people into this guild, not just to fill their minds with knowledge, but to acquaint them with what my old Jesuit teachers used to call the perennial philosophy, which I call the perennial wisdom, a sense what it means to be human, what it means to exist in the world, that comes at us from stories that have been passed on in many cultures down through the years, orally and in writing. And that to do that, we need to give some room for the pre-play of curiosity, eclecticism. Returning to write to literature has been wonderful for me in terms of rounding out. I never lost it. I've read and I'll continue to read novels and literature. But it's not my field. You know. I'm not following literary theory, which God forbid I should know too much about. But I have no compunction about shredding from this and teaching it because it enriches me. Nothing enriches, helps to enrich students. And I have no idea of how it might be useful in informing, what I do in history as a historian now, how I view. So there's a kind of opening out of breath to learning that involves a free play of creativity and of curiosity that goes all the way back to me wandering around the stacks, when I was a college student, bringing books off the shelf that had nothing to do with any test that I was going to take or now any lecture that I'm going to prepare. So that's part of the distancing that I would see. There's also a kind of distancing that has to do with writing and scholarship, and that's a distancing that says, I'm in this, but this is also to some extent, this is related to me, this is to some extent flowing through me. It is that when I write, keep introducing parentheses here, a friend of mine, Jeff Stouter, teaches at Princeton, gave the most beautiful verbal bouquet to me at a session at the AAR a couple of years back, devoted to slave religion and its influence on the field of African-American religious history. In which he pointed out that in the text as he read it, I effaced my ego so that the voices and the presence of those I'm writing about the subjects becomes present. And I invite thereby other people to come into the room to meet the people and to experience their importance. And I thought, wow, if I did that, that's exactly what I would have wanted to do. So there's a kind of humility about our writing that sometimes is lacking in texts that we read. Texts are so clotted with ego and with the current debates, scoring points in those debates, that the subject gets occluded by that kind of egotism of the author. It's most obvious. This is caveat, but it's most obvious symptom is the increasing level of texts that that are being written by our colleagues. Anyway, that's caveat on your side. It has some truth to it. Another sense of distancing has to do. And this, I'm going to say this, and again, I'll have to refer you to another essay because it would take too long for me to explicate right now. It's the first essay in, it's the introductory essay in Fire in the Bones. It's called Praying the ABCs. And this was an essay that I gave, a talk that I gave to the group that produces Cross Currents, who we call the Society for Values in Higher Education. And what it does is reflections, and this I think would be most helpful for your question. It's a reflection on how I relate being a historian to being a believer. What's the dialogue that goes back and forth between those two? And in a sense, the subtext is exactly your question. So borrow that copy and Xerox it. That is.
Distance that you've been talking about,
encoded
as marginality, though.
And
that's
also
the side of this, is what does it mean to be marginal?
There are degrees of marginality. I mean, I would agree that that joining a contemplative monastery is, at least on the face of it, more marginalized than teaching at Princeton. But part of what I'm arguing in the Holy Ordinary is there's something that's only apparent about that. That is, Merton has a famous Fourth and Walnut experience. There's a plaque where this Enlightenment experience occurred at another site. I visited this plaque when I was in Louisville a couple of years ago to visit Merton's monastery, Gethsemane. And it's Walnut has now been called, is now called Muhammad Ali Avenue. Mm-hmm. And, but they've now dedicated that square as Thomas Merton Square. And so here's a plaque as to this experience. Yeah, I'm going to describe the experience. And actually, if you pass me, I think it's in the essay.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So that's, you've got the essay. Okay. I don't have the essay. Okay. So I'm standing there in the cold, having my photo taken by the current curator of the Merton Collection. And a local black woman from Louisville is walking by, and she looks at me, and she laughs. And she said, have you had your Enlightenment experience? I said, no, and it's damn cold out here. but apropos of this marginality, I mean, Merton realized, long before this passage, but the passage brings it to the core, that being a monk doesn't mean you've left the world behind. So all this is relative stuff, and all of it has to do with your attitude about the world. And so marginality is the one where you create in your life a certain amount of space so that you have the time for silence, for solitude, for contemplative reflection, which distances you from the hurly-burly of the world, from the daily getting, and struggles of the world, so that you can have some perspective on it. Now, that might be done through, a weekly Sabbath. A real Sabbath. And a real Sabbath in the sense of the book by that name, in which, you go off. For me, it's often as a walk in the woods. Just some time when I can allow myself to stand outside of myself and to let some perspective seep in. So in that sense of marginalization, I mean, if you go to a monastery and you're as busy as you were in the world, then you're not marginalized. There's another way of marginalization, and I try to argue that in the King Book essay, Healing and Wholeness. There's the marginality of being totally committed to something, you know, of a kind of activism, which can also take you off yourself, so that you are involved, as I have been last year, with a place called Emmaus House in Central Harlem, Hospitality for the Poor, and in which, through serving the poor, you can get a different perspective on the wealth. I can get a different perspective on the wealth of my life, and to see how poor my life is in some certain regards through the eyes of those that I'm working with in Central Harlem. So those are disruptive ways from our habitual activities in the academy, in the church, in writing, in our daily life. That's what they're doing. Yeah. Yes.
I was wondering, throughout, I really enjoyed your Merton essay. And one of the things you mentioned in that essay is that among the several convergences that Merton King had, one of them that they share is a recognition of the Kairos moment.
Yes.
You talk about that they were both able to sort of have a perception of the vision clear enough to see that the civil rights movement was about something more, that God was at work there in a providential way. And I agree with that. My question to you is maybe a bit more speculative, which is just that one of the things that you maybe don't describe in as much detail in the essay is how you think King and Merton both came to be able to do that. And so I wonder, number one, what kinds of training do you think are necessary for us to recognize a Kairos moment the way that King and Merton did? And then, two, do you see a Kairos moment in the world right now? Do you see a place where God is providentially at work?
Good questions.
I'm not sure which one is harder.
They're all hard. The training I try to suggest in the essay, and this also is narrative fiction, because as they write about these particular moments, or in King's case, as someone else writes about it from his own speeches, the kitchen experience, kitchen table experience, and the Fourth and Walnut experience, revelatory moments in which, in King's case, there's recognition, I'm going to die because of this, because someone's going to kill me. And yet, you know, I've got to do it. I'm frightened. I'm at my wit's end. How can I get out of this? And he hears this voice, you know, saying, I will be with you. So there's a kind of a movement that, you know, of grace that breaks through into his consciousness at a critical moment, which pushes him and sustains him on this road that he's about. And once that's happened, he begins to see the Kairos moment in terms of a movement. It's not that there hadn't been movement activities before, boycotts before, but suddenly to see this as blossoming into a movement, and the energy that's filling those churches night after night, and singing the hymns and the sermons, it all suggests the sense that something bigger is going on. So you have an individual moment of grace, and then you have a communal moment of grace. There's a kind of common consciousness here that's sustaining these people through the pain and asceticism and difficulty of what they're going through day after day after day, walking, refusing rides. This is something bigger yourself. If you ever watched Awakenings from the Eyes and the Pearls series, the interviews with people who were involved in the movement, some of them foot soldiers in the movement, it's amazing to see their faces in terms of what this meant to them and how they felt at the time. And so, just their own testimonies gives you a sense of people who see something as historical happening at this point. For Merton, I think the recognition comes about through his term, which is actually a return to social awareness, political awareness, with a vengeance in 63, when he writes one of the most perceptive articles about race that I've seen anywhere at that time or since, called Letter to a White Liberal, which is published in a book called Seeds of Destruction. It's the height of the optimism. It's after the March on Washington, height of optimism. And King says there's going to be violence. The white liberals are going to sell you down the river one more time when they see how much this is going to cost. You can pass laws, but it's not going to change the pattern in the North, where people are happy for integration to take place in the South but don't want it to happen in their neighborhoods. This is going to involve a total disruption of business as usual in society. And unless we're willing to pay the cost, there's going to be a lot more pain and agony to come. Martin Marty writes a critical review of that in the Chicago Herald's Sunday book review, in which he accuses Merton of hiding behind monastery walls as some kind of imitation James Baldwin, which is not too far wrong because Merton had been reading James Baldwin and talking about being a translator of James Baldwin to audiences that would have never read James Baldwin. So Merton, something's happened to Merton, which is restoring him with a vengeance to his earlier interest from his Columbia days in politics and war. And then he becomes a virulent critic of the Vietnam War, which he calls an overwhelming atrocity. So he's from the monastery, behind the monastery, he has an amazingly acute sense of what's happening through his reading, through conversations with people. People he's talking with. And in the summer of 67, it all happens. Martin Marty writes a retraction in the National Catholic Reporter of his earlier review, saying, you told it like it was and like it is. And so Merton's perceptiveness from his position of marginality about social conditions and the linking, as King did, of consumerism, materialism, militarism, and war, and linking it to this inchoate fear of death very profoundly comes from his contemplative vision. He's writing, he's in touch with an amazing variety of people, from Latin American poets whom he reads in Spanish to Boris Pasternak, who he has a long conversation, an epistolary conversation with, to just lots of people. It's helping to inform his consciousness of the Kairos moment. And so for Merton, I think it's the return, which is symbolized by that fourth moment experience. Following the spurious idea of holiness, of rejecting the world. I'm known as the guy who wrote the seven story novel. I'm no longer him. I didn't leave New York in a huff and chop on Cincinnati with Thoreau in one pocket and John of the Cross in the other. I love beer, by that very fact, I'm a human being. The world came with me into the monastery. The monastery is in the world. So it's that turn to recognizing himself as a guilty bystander, that allows him to have the perceptiveness to comment on this as a charisma. And has been impressed. And he talks about the children of Birmingham. He writes a poem about the children of Birmingham. And he's reading Baldwin, he's reading Malcolm X, he's reading Mac Brown, writes reviews, appreciative reviews of all these people. He's reading black fiction. William Melvin Kelly, a guy you've never heard of, writes about him. I hate to keep referencing my work, but I've written a piece that was published in the, what's the journal that comes out of Bill Nova, Catholic Social Ethics? Anybody know that journal? I think that's the title. It's,
I'll get it done. Send it around along with the cross.
Yeah, it's on Merton on Race. It's called View from the Margins.
Okay.
So it's on precisely on that. I began by talking about the fact that Eldridge Cleaver, of all people, read Merton's Seven Story Mountain and thought, hey, the man knows what's happening.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, just amazing. So he, you know, he was very perceptive. And I think that's how this epiphany that came to him slowly. I mean, it was probably you can see things happening in his journals before this, but somehow catalyzed by this experience. And the experience, as it's written about in his journals, is very different from the it's published account. So he's been thinking about what the experience meant, and comes to it with a different lens when he writes about it, has it published in disputed questions. That's I think how they came to it for Carlos Moon. Question about what does one do about a Kairos moment? I think that was your second question.
Do you see a Kairos moment?
No. No, I don't. Which doesn't mean that we're not in one, but I don't see it. And one might see one's own individual history as having Kairos moments. I also, in that essay that I just referred to, caution about depending on Kairos moments. Because if you depend on Kairos moments, then they happen, and then you come down from the mountainside, or Kairos is you missed it, and that's an excuse for not doing anything. And what we've learned about the civil rights movement is any dates that you give for the beginning of the civil rights movement or the end of the civil rights movement are wrong. That the civil rights movement was led up to by a long series of small k Kairos moments or heroic actions by individual people and by groups of people going back to the early 20th century. It's kind of like We Shall Overcome. We Shall Overcome apparently originates partly in terms of the word, the tune, and spiritual. It then gets written down as a church hymn by Albert Timley. And his son by churches as I Shall Overcome. It then gets used as a work song by white and black workers. It gets picked up by some black women in Charleston, South Carolina, and used in a strike that they are organizing. It gets picked up by Pete Seeger. It gets taught to Guy and Carrie Carawan, Candy Carawan, at the Highlander School under Miles Horton, and then becomes the anthem of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, it's that complex development of this song, this anthem of the movement, is a kind of level of complexity of the Civil Rights Movement. Paul Harvey's book that looks at the origins of the Civil Rights Movement exhaustively in the first long chapter points out some of that complexity. So Kairos moments both do emerge mysteriously, and yet there's long preparation for them. Similarly, you've got to be careful about talking about something ending, especially when there are individuals around the country who are doing amazing organizing and work. Some of them called coming out of Paul Levinsky's kind of block on the name of it.
Industrial
Areas Foundation. Ada Cortez, Jr., and others. Influenced by the civil rights movement, and by, you know, in his case, by Sidney Chavez. So things have ripple effects. If you're only looking for the Kairos movement, you'll miss that long beginning, and hopefully not long looking past. And it can be used as an excuse for inaction, especially inaction on the local level. There's no good movement anymore. There are no canyons or no mountain exits or whatever. They're not down a dozen anymore. But we then have to work on the David Slow, long, not King's Own Woods, long and slow, but beautiful. Frustrating, long, slow, frustrating, but beautiful slow, to try and create communities and justice and peace and solidarity day by day.
And that's where the contemplative disciplines and spiritual nourishment promise to sustain those Kairos moments or those bursts of moral energy over the time when it's no longer sexy to be working in some southern backwater or in some marginal place. I've always felt a certain sadness in looking at King's life in terms of his ability to find places of retreat and solitude. I had not heard until I read your essay that he had made arrangements to visit Gethsemane to retreat there. It's really heartbreaking. I don't know much about his solitary spiritual life from the years after the Montgomery bus boycott. And I'm wondering if you can say anything about that. Did he make retreats? Did he have a spiritual advisor? I know Howard Thurman and King remained in contact, and that Thurman had the same kind of concern for King and maybe invited him to do a retreat.
I've run across no evidence of that. And I think most of his retreats were the few vacations that he had. But I don't know of any occasion for real privacy other than jail. So one might think of jail time as, in some sense, a time of solitude. But even there, he's letter from Birmingham jail, and he's strategizing and things like that. So he's not there's not much he's pretty, by the end of his life, he's pretty exhausted. He's had, at least from the biographers that have written about that. And there does seem to be in his desire, as expressed by the time he gets to Chicago, that something's missing here. I need something to really recharge the batteries. And if Garreau is right, I mean, he's drinking heavily, he's smoking too much, he's gaining a lot of weight, signs of somebody who's not totally comfortable with himself. So I don't think that he's having much opportunity. He was carrying Jesus and the Disinherited with him, but I don't think he's he's got the fruits of meditation that are behind Thurman's books, except for perhaps some of his sermons. But even then, as he gets busier and busier, he just doesn't have the time, I don't think. So the answer to your question, if someone may know something that's been available to us, but I didn't see it. I've read about King's daily life. It's pretty.
You have to be careful when you
say this, but would you, or ask this, but would you consider the moral dissipation of King in his final years part of the cost or liability of bearing witness to the nonviolent cross of Jesus in a nation that is driven, identified by militarism, war, violence?
Well, it's interesting, and this is not a justification of King's infidelity or of Merton's. Merton had an affair with the young nurse late in life, which was discovered through an accidental overhearing of a conversation between the two by Father Monk, who poured into the cabin. Otherwise, it would have continued on. In the case of King, I wonder what psychological costs were of being the son of a very successful and very demanding father, and the psychological costs of being the leader of a movement whose love for what he does, rather than perhaps what he is. I wonder in Merton's case about the psychological costs of being informed by his mother that she was dying and he would never see her again by letter when he was 5 years old, and the difficulties that he had in relating comfortably emotionally with women after that, which his dreams, about some of his dreams, was referring to, and finally having the opportunity to actually fall in love with a woman. So I see these infidelities to vows in both cases as perhaps having deep emotional roots in childhood experiences with parents and in the vocational the cost of the vocational choices that both people made. In Merton's case, the choice for a solitary life, which proves not even solitary enough, so that he has to move into a hermitage, and yet one which he has a tremendous desire to communicate with people on a very deep level. As I say, in this essay, that he's a hermit, a very gregarious hermit. And that gregariousness shows up in just the volumes of letters that he writes. So those would be my ways, not of justifying, but of trying to understand the infidelities of both people.
Thank you.
Question. As I'm thinking about these revelatory moments, I think some people point to at least the King kitchen table experience as almost a conversion experience of a sort.
Yeah, which he never had in terms of baptism.
Again,
I mean the Baptist notion. Just to what's happened now, he doesn't ever have it.
And then the Merton at that corner. And I'm thinking about juxtaposing that with the idea of participation in the humanity, human species. All of us, are guilty bystanders, I think is, I don't know if that's your language, but that was Merton's language. And then I think also Merton's language, perhaps of living in a minor key.
That's my
And that's your language. And thinking about what it means for us, and part of it is perhaps just the American individualism, but I'm curious what it means. There are certain emphases in other cultures of individuals being
their identity being their participation in humanity. Perhaps their identity as part of being image bearers, part of the image of God, or part of this collective social movement or a cultural movement, whether it's a teleological conception of the human species. And what do we take from the idea of understanding ourselves as guilty bystanders on the one hand, being made in the image of God on the other, and then this conception of a person's identity as primarily being part of this collective, I think Martin's language, a member of the race in which God became incarnate, or something like that. And so is this image, is this a relationality? Is it understood in terms of human actions? Is it understood in terms of an end towards which we're ordered? Or is it more individualistic than that?
Okay.
Unless someone had a whole of those things together.
Yeah, that's worth a lot of meditation. It's a very profound question. Let me try and make a stab at it by trying to bring together some things from various parts of my work. In Greek Orthodoxy, Eastern Orthodoxy, which I converted about 15 years ago now, the concept of the human person is relation, and that is theologically explained in part by the Imago Dei, the image of God, concept that we are created in the image and likeness of God, and that God is a trinity of persons, that God is interpersonal relations. Metropolitan Johnson says he was this being as communion. There's a full articulation of that. So human persons, by what they are created in the image of God as interpersonal. But to be a person is to be interrelated, personally with others, is to seek communion with others. And that communion is not restricted to the present. We have interpersonal relationships with those who have gone before, which is represented by the whole system of saints, communion of saints, as it's called to the West, who continue to influence our lives, and who do icons are present, made present in our lives. Now, the particularity of the image of God is conveyed to us not just by that text in Genesis, but is presented to us by the icon of God, who is Christ. I'm using Paul in the language. Christ is the icon of Christ. So in the tradition of iconography, every icon is an icon of the person who is the icon of Christ. So Christ is the mediator of this iconic relationship with those who have gone before, those who are here among us, and those who will come after. And that community is affected by the incarnation and the development of the church. That's what the church is. The church is a community that bears witness to God's having become man and made it possible for the image of God in which we were all created to be realized, and to be realized fully on a personal level, individual level, if you want, through the process of theosis. This again is based upon Pauline epistles, the notion that goes back to the Father's
think it's Athanasius who says, God became man so that man made a covenant with God. Not by nature, but by grace. So the whole process of the individual's development is to become more and more like the image in which we were created. To become more and more like God, to become divinized. Now, that in that process, the process, while it affects us as individuals, is also a process that involves everyone else, because the person is interpersonal. And therefore, there's a solidarity. There is a, what's the term I want? I guess solidarity have to do. There's a solidarity, a communion of persons, again, which is most highly realized in the church, the body of Christ extended through time and space, in which, and I'll be quoting him tonight, St. Isaac the Syrian discusses the compassionate person, the person in solidarity with others, as being one who sorrows for and weeps for the all beings in the cosmos that suffer. And let's see. Find the talk. I hope I have it with me. And I'll quote it directly. It's a nice quote, so bear with me while I'm up here. Sense of, I think I quote him in.
It's in here.
It's in
here. Yeah, it's in that
as well. Yeah. So there's a sense of a communion with all being that comes out of this process of theosis. An enlarging of one's being to be in solidarity with all it is, which would make sense if it was becoming more Catholic. That would make sense. Now, there are other ways of talking about this. Thurman talks about this in very interesting ways in his book, In Search of Common Ground, in which he talks about the very thrust of beings from the simplest cell on is towards communion. Towards communion with others. And the frustration of that thrust is to frustrate being. Therefore racism, for example, break in which breaks the possibility of communion, is a frustration not just of the society, but of members of that society at the deepest level of their being. And there are a number of other ways of talking about it. For me, one of the most profound ways is the theological understanding of the person which I've experienced in Orthodoxy. Now, where sin fits in with this is that sin never destroys the image of God within the person. But what sin does is it occludes that image. It hides it. It makes it impossible for the radiance of the image to shine forth. Again, the whole tradition of iconography, that if you look at an icon, it's flat. There's no vanishing point in it. And that's because it's meant to reflect back at you the light that shines out of this person who is an image of God. And that light is the light, the same light that that the apostles see emanating from Christ on Mount Tabor. It's the light of Tabor. And that's the light which the person involved in the process of theosis is to shine out. Because that person is in the process of becoming more and more like the image of God, becoming more and more like the icon of God, which Christ is. So the light of Mount Tabor, this is talked about, extensively by St. Gregory Palamas in the 14th century, is the light that shines out of those icons, what they're meant to represent. And therefore, they're reminders of what it is that each person who venerates the icon is supposed to imitate, to become. This is your calling. This is what you're going to be. And once again, the ultimate icon of God, the only reason, this goes back to that kind of classic controversy, the only reason that is that you're justified in writing or in painting an icon is because Christ became man, because Christ is the icon. If God had not become incarnate, you could not depict God. There are no icons of the Trinity, except one, which is not a true icon and doesn't represent the Trinity. It symbolizes the Trinity. And that's the hospitality of Abraham. You may have seen a great icon by Asher Rudolph, that's one of the models of it, in which Abraham, you see the three angels, and they all look like each other, except the robes are different colors, symbolizing the different persons of the Trinity. And they're seated around the table. And the way in which Rudolph is constructed in it is that there's an ongoing circular movement in the Trinity, which is the perichoresis, the dance of love, the circle of love that continually passes from Father to Son to Holy Spirit and back to Father. Now, that represents the Trinity because it represents the hospitality of Abraham. In other words, the only icon representing the Trinity represents the act of hospitality, which is the act of communion, interpersonal relationship among us, eating at a table. And the table is the Eucharistic table. And so the primary source of the transformation of us into the image in whose likeness we were made, the source of that is the church as the body of Christ that extends through time, the Eucharist, the transformation of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. Hence, Smaemont's comment that the church exists in the world for the sake of transforming the world through the sacrament. This gets back to the sacraments, especially through the sacrament of the Eucharist. So that's the way in which it all holds together.
Can you get all that?
Yes. Thank you. I hope that, I mean, it's complex, profound, but it's also beautiful. I hope some of it is conveyed.
Yes. We have time for only one more question.
Oh, it's got to be from my...
Yes, it's your patriot. I'm afraid my question is not very profound.
Good.
I was wondering if you could say a few more words about your interest in religion and literature and what you see as the possible future of that subfield that some people say. I'm curious if you're interested, if you're...
I hadn't thought about that, but I think there probably is. I mean, I think part of it is, again, my interest in education as getting us in touch with the wisdom traditions of the world, and the ways in which wisdom has conveyed insights on what it means to be human, and what it means to exist in the world, comes to us through literature, through stories.
And is there work in that subfield that you find, recent work in that subfield that you find appealing?
Yeah, I'll be talking about some of it tonight, but more recent, the three of the texts I'm talking about tonight aren't that recent. One is Faulkner's The Bear. The other is Flannery O'Connor's Revelation. And the third is James Baldwin's Gotenna on the Mountain. Fourth, I'm going to just briefly talk about at the end, is a book by Mark Saltzman called Lying Awake, which is about a cloistered Carmelite nun in Los Angeles who is having visions after 28 years of life in a convent, in which 25 of those years have been just desolate dryness. She's had these fantastic, vivid visions, and she's writing poetry and essays on contemplative life. It's becoming known. And unfortunately, she's also suffering increasingly painful migraines. And her mother superior orders her to have a neurological exam. And she has a benign form of epilepsy that's being caused by a tumor on the temporal lobe. And if she gets the tumor removed, her visions will cease. She finds out. And so she's got a choice to make. And I'm not telling you any more about it. It's a beautiful novel, very short. And I wish I'd read it. So each word counts. Another is Marilynne Robinson's Gilead.
Is there scholarly work in the subfield that you find?
I haven't really read that much scholarly work. There are some people working it, including Professor here, Regan Gorian, whose work I have dipped into. I'm trying to think. Nobody leaves to mind, but that may be just because I'm ignorant. Merton writes about some fiction. He writes about Faulkner. There's a book called The Literary, Collected Literary Essays of Merton, which and talks about Samuel O'Connor and a few others. Some other people, William Trevor, Irish novelist, mainly known as short story writer, but highly recommend A Death in Summer. Very moving. He just published a new book, which I have, and I haven't had a chance yet to read because of this stupid lecture I've got to give today. it's just out. I can't think of the title right now. Mamal Suri, Indian mathematician, teaches, I think, at Johns Hopkins, wrote an amazingly good first novel called The Death of Vishnu. I'm forgetting some. Well, some of the older folks, Walker Percy, George Brisson's wonderful, Robert Brisson's wonderful movie, The Diary of the Country Priest, which is based on George Bernanos' novel, The Diary of the Country Priest. It's a wonderful older classic that deals with. Bernanos was really influenced by Thérèse of Lisieux, the Little Flower, and The Diary of the Country Priest is his version of Journal of the Soul by Thérèse. Who am I forgetting? Not a novelist, but a poet, T.S. Eliot, Four Quartets. There's a lot of reading and meditation. And there are others I'm just blanking on. Those would be some of the texts that I would recommend reading. And if I come across any good critical literature on this, there's a whole project. Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, that comes out of Wheaton College, led by Roger Lundin, Lundin, who wrote a book on Emily Dickinson. They have a series of conferences, I was invited to one of them where I did a paper but Lundin has edited a volume, I can't remember the name of the volume, but it's called Something Voices, Invisible Voices, something like that. Just came out, and I have an essay on it called Obama and Juliet, Meaning and Mourning in African American Autobiography. And but this was the papers that were given at the third conference that this group had been meeting. Third time they had met, I wasn't invited to the first two. So there's a series of critical essays in that volume, and presumably the two earlier volumes, but I don't know the title of those. Another person who's been writing critically is Ralph Wood on Flannery O'Connor and Walker Percy and some others, who teaches at Baylor. So those would be some ends into some of the critical writing of this literature. the conference that was held up at the American Academy of Religions offices, American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Cambridge near the Divinity School, was really interesting. There were some interesting people there. And I don't know if these names are meaning to you. I don't know about Bonko, who's a Puritan scholar and wrote a book on Melville as well, was there. A number of folks who are, you know, they aren't religious studies, secular kind of literary critics who are there and very interested in these issues. Dennis Donahue was one of the people who was there. So I would get that on and you know, ask Charles if you email me, I'll send you the reference.
Well, Professor Robindel, you've given us such a gift today with your presence and sharing your wisdom and inspiring us towards that hidden wholeness that binds all of us together as a way of thinking about our vocations as scholars and theologians, students. Thanks so much for helping us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Learn how to connect head and heart.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and thanks all of you for reading you know, my work and for your profound questions. And one of the things that's nice is to realize that people actually read what you write. That's nice to know that they have reactions to it. So thank you.
We can keep talking for a while, but I need to
gather myself.
Sick my voice.
Thank you.